Cases. I'd like to call to order the Civil Law and Data Practices Committee for 2015, and welcome everyone. I'd like to start with introductions, and what I'd like to do, since we have a couple of staff still getting into place, I'd like to start with members. We have some new faces around the table, obviously, some newly elected folks, and so I'd like to just start with introductions. Representative Vogel, would you like to start?
Good morning. I'm Bob Vogel. I live in Elko Newmarket. I'm in District 20A and represent Southern Scott and Western Leesore County.
Thank you. I'm John Applebaum. I represent District 44B, which includes parts of Minnetonka, Plymouth, and an area named Woodland. It's my hometown district. Excited to be here and work with everyone.
I'm Deborah Hillstrom. I represent all of the City of Brooklyn Center and parts of Brooklyn Park.
Peggy Scott. I represent Andover, Northern Coon Rapids, and a precinct in Ramsey, Minnesota.
Dennis Smith, District 34B, Maple Grove and Osseo.
Glenn Grunhagen, Sibley and McLeod County.
Kathy Lomer, I represent District 39B, which is part of Stillwater, Lake Elmo, about 12 communities on the St. Croix River.
Nick Sarwaz, District 30A, Big Lake Township, City of Elk River, and a little bit about Seago.
Thank you. And let's start with staff then. Mary, do you want to begin? Ms. Mullen.
I'm Mary Mullen from House Research.
I'm Callie Lehman, the CA for the Civil Law Committee.
Let's stop 1 second and go right here.
I'm Lauren Sweeney, GOP Research.
Alex Boyatt, CLA.
Matt Gehring, also from Nonpartisan House Research.
And we have a GOP, or excuse me, a DFL researcher.
Hi, I'm Laura Taking Holtzie.
Thank you. And our pages and Assistant Sergeant of Arms here, if you want to introduce yourselves.
Hi, I'm Andrew.
Welcome. Thank you so much. Well, what we're going to start with this morning, you should have in your packets a copy of the committee rules, and just would like to have the members of the committee review those, and if you have any questions, please feel free. I think these weren't emailed out ahead of time, were they? So. We'll talk about the rules in depth if there are any questions at our next committee meeting, but they are there for your review. And we have a couple of other members that walked in the door, so let's we've done introductions. Representative Hoppe, if you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Representative Hoppe. Morning.
Representative Hoppe, you want to explain, tell people where you're from? Who you represent?
Yes, I am from Chaska. I represent all of Chaska, half of Chanhassen and half of Victoria. And I apologize to Madam Chair and the committee members. I'm leaving. I am going to the Motor Vehicle Insurance Coverage Verification Task Force meeting. Anybody want to come with? but I will be here normally. I just have to leave and go to that for the rest of the morning.
Understandable. So. Thank you. I appreciate
Thank
you. You're going there.
Happy to be back on civil law.
Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'm Dave Pinto from the southwestern part of St. Paul, Highland Park and McAllister Groveland are the neighborhoods I represent, and glad to be here. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And we've got more members trickling in here. We'll see who sits first. Minority lead on the committee is Representative Lesh. If you'd like to introduce yourself and tell folks where you're from.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Lesh, District 66B, St. Paul. That's Como Park, North End, East Side, Como, Hamlin Midway. And I'm very happy to be here.
Thank you. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dan Schoen, Cottage Grove, Newport, St. Paul Park, South St. Paul, and Great Cloud Island Township.
Very good. And Representative Johnson.
I represent District 32A, which is mostly by Santa County and Northern Chisago County.
Very good. Thank you. Very, very well, folks. What I'd like to do next is get to our agenda. And first up is House Researcher Matt Gehring, and he's going to give us an overview. There you are. Of data practices from House Research. Okay, Mary's going to got to get used to calling you Ms. Mullen instead of Mary. Go ahead.
Thanks, Chair and Representatives. I'm Mary Mullen from the House Research Department, and Matt Gehring and I are going to present to you a little bit about some civil law topics. I'm going to start with giving you a bit of background. I know a lot of people on this committee have either worked in the area of civil law as attorneys or in other capacities, or they've been on the Civil Law Committee, so I won't spend very much time on it, but for those of you who are new to the area, civil law generally touches on any kind of law that is not criminal law. So some concrete examples of that are property law, that could include real estate or sales, torts, what we commonly think of as liability, or the rights and duties people owe to each other. This includes various aspects of malpractice, contract law, civil rights law, family law, and then privacy. And with privacy in there, we include the issues like data practices. So legislation relating to civil law centers around a number of different areas. And often what this committee is looking at is the remedies people can get in court. So this includes whether or not you have a right to sue, what we call a cause of action. That's a term you'll probably hear when you're here in committee. Whether or not there's a statute of limitations or how long somebody can wait to bring a lawsuit. Damages, how much somebody can get through a lawsuit and what kind of damages you can get. You hear about these from time to time, actual damages, your financial losses, or punitive damages, which are intended to punish somebody in a case. We also talk about whether or not somebody can get awarded attorney's fees or other court costs in cases, who has the burden of proof, which side has to prove a case, or the standard of proof, the kind of things you hear about on Law and Order, or if you practice beyond a reasonable doubt or a preponderance of the evidence. Sometimes we can use technical legal terms, and it's always fine to ask questions if you're not sure about something that's going on in committee. Then there are issues like notice and due process, how parties learn about various aspects of the case. And this is what's required of the participants in the case, the government, and the court. And you know, these are intended to make sure a process is fair. So these are going to be issues that come up when you're talking about certain types of cases in civil law, especially when it comes to the courts. And this committee has an interesting jurisdiction because it is so large, as you can imagine from what I just said. It's a very large area. And a lot of things you hear about in this committee, you'll also hear about in other committees like the Judiciary Committee, Health and Human Services, Commerce. So if you sit on any of those committees, you might hear about some of those similar issues. And there's a couple issues that are very prominent in the area of civil law. And one of those is data privacy issues, and Matt's going to talk a little bit about that. And the other one is family law issues, and I'm going to give a little bit of a background on that. So I'll turn it over to Matt for a minute.
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair and members, again, for the record, my name is Matt Gehring from House Research. I'm just going to talk really quickly about data practices. I know you have a more formal presentation from Stacey Christensen coming up next, so I'm not going to do a whole big overview of Chapter 13. But just to bring you up to speed on a few of the issues that I would expect the committee is likely to hear about related to data practices this session, the list that I have for you is based on the work of the Data Practices Commission. So those of you that were around last session remember that there was a law enacted that established a Data Practices Commission for the first time. This interim, that commission has been meeting over the course of the summer and the fall, including Representative Scott and Representative Lesch and Representative Simonson from the House, as well as three senators, and now former Representative Mary Liz Holberg as the chair. So many of the data practices issues that the commission worked on over the summer are issues that are likely to see some sort of legislative action or at least some sort of legislative attention this coming session. Those issues include classification of data related to automated license plate readers. So for those of you that are new, an automated license plate reader is one of these devices that a law enforcement agency can set up in a parking lot or on a street corner or on the back of a car or something, and the device can actually collect license plates using a camera and a data collector. And issues that the legislature has been concerned about with these readers in the past relates to the the way the data that's collected is handled and used and how long it's stored for. So last session there was a bill to classify license plate reader data, or to either classify it or require that it be destroyed if there's no particular hit discovered with a piece of data that's collected. That bill made it to conference committee last session and sort of stalled out in the committee, so I would expect that that's likely to be an issue that the committee will need to deal with this session. Another related piece of law enforcement data that the committee is likely to hear about is related to the use of body cameras by law enforcement. Many of the same issues that affect license plate readers will affect data related to body cameras, including who's collecting the data, who can access it, and how long can body camera data be retained by law enforcement. Another separate issue that is likely to come up at some point this session relates to data collected by contractors with the state. So those of you who have been around in the past recall there's a Minnesota Supreme Court case called Timberjay that affected the application of the Data Practices Act to state contractors. There was a legislative amendment to the law in 2014 to clarify that the Data Practices Act does apply to contractors with government entities. The legislative fix last session did include a provision that exempted health plan providers from the data practices requirement until July 2015. So you're likely to hear from the health plans this session at some point about either extending that exemption or providing some other clarification to the law related to how data practices does apply to health plans. A couple of other issues include bulk sales of motor vehicle data. This issue relates to an ongoing dispute between the Department of Public Safety and private business and other sort of media outlets. They've had a dispute for a couple of years now about gaining access to motor vehicle records in bulk form. Some of these institutions collect the data for purposes of, for example, notifying vehicle owners about recalls or other issues other vehicle issues, and the department and these private entities have sort of been at a standstill for a couple of years over the proper way to access data in bulk form. So that's likely to be an issue that you'll hear about again this session. And finally, just a bigger issue that doesn't have a specific history necessarily with a particular bill draft, but is an issue that's, I would say, is sort of growing in interest over the past couple of years, includes issues related to access to educational records and how educational records are collected both by K-12 institutions as well as post-secondary institutions. There's been increasing concern among members of this committee over the past couple of years related to how the data is collected and the rights of students and parents to opt out of educational record databases and how they can review the data that's maintained on them by these institutions. And so, again, this is an issue that you're likely to hear about at some point this session.
Thank you, Mr. Kering. And Ms. Mullen, you want to go ahead with the family law piece?
Sure. Thank you, Chair and Representatives. I'm just going to tell you a little bit of some background about family law. It is a topic that's kind of perennial in this committee and does come through here. Some of the issues that family law encompasses are marriage and divorce, child custody and visitation for both married and unmarried parents, paternity, child support, spousal maintenance, adoption, child protection, and third-party custody and grandparent visitation. So those are some of the issues that do come up in this area. Some of those issues also you'll hear about in the Human Services Committee or in the Judiciary Committee as well. One of the things that's unique about family law is that it involves a couple of different courts. In Minnesota, we have juvenile courts. These tend to hear adoption cases and child protection cases, and we call those cases CHIPS. That's an abbreviation you'll hear from time to time. Then there's family court, which involves divorce and a lot of custody cases. We also have an expedited child support system in Minnesota, so those referees who handle those can usually handle just child support issues and then some paternity cases as well. So each of these courts operates a little bit different procedurally, and there are special family law rules as well, general practice rules that affect just family law in Minnesota that are outside of the normal civil procedure rules. There aren't any state agencies in particular that deal with family law, but there can be involvement from the Attorney General at times, the Department of Human Services, the county child support workers and social service workers, as well as the county attorney. So those are groups that you would typically hear from. It related to some family law issues, they would come in usually and testify, as well as many special interest groups that are interested in those issues. Minnesota Statute 517 covers marriage, 518 covers divorce and custody and visitation, 518A does child support, 518B is domestic abuse, and I could go on and on. Family law statutes in Minnesota are not all located in one place. 257 governs some of the rights of unmarried parents, so it is spread out throughout the statutes, and you know, it's not, unfortunately, all in one place. I'm not going to go into the substance of any of the laws in those areas, but you're more than welcome to ask anyone in House Research or myself or Matt to help you with those, or any of your caucus researchers to help you if you have any questions specific to any particular family law issues. Family law reforms over the last few years have been difficult to reach consensus. That might be an understatement. The changes have happened generally incrementally, but one of the larger changes that's happened over the last few years was that a new child support calculation took effect that came into effect January 1 of 2007, and that was a relatively large change that updated the Minnesota law so that both parents' income were considered when they were calculating child support. There's also a number of uniform laws that have passed over the last few years, and those are some of the things that have actually been done in family law that have passed with some ease. And this is the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act. That went into effect in 2014. It governs enforcement and income withholding for child support and spousal maintenance. The Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction and Enforcement Act, that went into effect in 1999, and that governs the jurisdiction of custody cases between states. And the Uniform Disposition of Community Property Rights at Death Act, which governs how to deal with property in a divorce that was acquired in a community property rights state. And that went into effect in 2013. So as you can see, family law, because people do move from state to state and they don't stay in one place, there's a lot of issues related to that jurisdiction. And so there's a number of uniform laws, and I do anticipate probably that uniform laws will continue to come through in that area. And updates to those uniform laws will probably happen as well. So please feel free to ask questions on any of the things Matt or I have talked about today or anything that comes through the committee. We're here to help and happy to help however we can.
Committee members have any questions or inquiries so far? Just an update on the family law. For some of you who are new to the legislature, was it 2012, we passed a bill for the presumption of joint of equal shared parenting. Both bodies passed the bill, and the governor pocket vetoed, saying that he wanted all stakeholders to come to the table, which hadn't happened before. So the last 2 years, myself, Representative Tim Mahoney, Representative Kim Norton, Representative Carolyn Lane, have been meeting with members of a broad coalition of people, from judges to family law referees, court referees, family law attorneys, bar association attorneys, early neutral evaluators, child psychologists, a whole myriad of people, and we have been working in a mediation sort of setting to come up with legislation that everyone can agree on. And last year we had three bills that the coalition came up with, and this year we'll have another group of bills that we'll be introducing. Right now those bills are being looked at by the constituency groups that are represented by the folks in the coalition. So we will be spending some time in family law. So also expect that we'll probably have an evening meeting or two, maybe, so that the parents and those that work during the day will be able to be here for the hearings to hear these bills. So with that, the next item on the agenda is Ms. Stacy Christensen from IPAD, and she's going to give us a presentation on data practices and a little bit, tell us a little bit about what IPAD does do. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair and representatives, my name is Stacy Christensen, and I'm the Director of the Information Policy Analysis Division in the Department of Administration. And thank you very much for having me today to talk a little bit about iPad and what iPad does. A brief overview of Chapter 13, the Government Data Practices Act, and then I'm just going to highlight some of the issues that Mr. Gehring discussed that the Data Practices Commission dealt with over the last summer and fall and winter. So to begin, I believe you have the PowerPoint in your packet of information that I'm just going to walk through. First of all, just to talk a little bit about iPad, for those of you that aren't familiar, as I mentioned, we are a division within the Department of Administration. We fall under the Community Services Group in admin, and we are the statewide resource for interpretation of both the Data Practices Act and the Open Meeting Law. So the bulk of what we do is provide informal advice to anyone who asks us, and that will include any members of the public, government entities, members of the media, and the legislature. Those are kind of the four broad groups that we place our customers into. We provide assistance to over 1,700 people every year, and you know it could be by phone call, by email, or in training. We also assist the Commissioner of Administration with his duties to issue non-binding advisory opinions, both in the areas of the Data Practices Act and the Open Meeting Law. So anyone can ask for an advisory opinion. A member of the public can ask about one concerning their either the rights to get public data, or if they're a subject of private data, they're basically privacy rights with regard to that. Government entities can ask for advisory opinions relating to issues that they're facing with regard to data practices. And folks can also request advisory opinions relating to the open meeting law. We have a website and informational materials. We have a listserv and a quarterly newsletter. We also provide training, primarily to government, but we also do try to train members of the public as well. And we partnered with the media over the last few years to provide kind of more public-based training and also training folks in the media who are a big user of the Data Practices Act. So we want to make sure they know how to best utilize the act to get the information that they need. Finally, we provide legislative assistance in that we are the neutral, kind of nonpartisan office that can assist with the technicalities of the Data Practices Act. So we like to answer questions about how a bill might fit in the existing framework of the Data Practices Act, what specific language should be used, what type of classification language should be used. So we are willing to help anyone that has any questions. We are there to help with any legislative drafting or just answer kind of general technical questions about the Data Practices Act. So definitely feel free to use us as a resource. In terms of just iPad's overview, we have an annual operating budget of $463,000 with 4.5 FTE. We also supplement some of that with some of our workshop, our developed curriculum, and we also have a contract with the Department of Health to assist them with some of their e-health privacy and security work. We, as I mentioned, assist and educate over 1,700 customers a year. We also, in addition to the advisory opinion authority, have delegated authority to manage the data challenge appeals process. So if an individual believes that a government entity is holding data about them that is, they believe, inaccurate or complete, there's a process in the Data Practices Act that allows them to challenge the data. And then if they don't agree with the government entity's determination, they can appeal that to the Commissioner of Administration, and it goes through a contested case process. We also have the Commissioner has authority to issue temporary classifications of data, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit toward the end with one of the current temporary classifications that we have, but it's basically the authority to approve or disapprove a request for a temporary classification of data that a government entity feels is necessary when the legislature is unable to classify the data when they're not in session. Finally, the commissioner has authority to evaluate requests for new uses of data, so a use that has not previously been put into statute, there's some authority around that as well. So, what do these four topics have in common? businesses that contract with government to perform government functions, license plate information captured by law enforcement, data breaches of the DVS database, and video from police body cameras. These are topics you've seen in the news in the last year and a half. So those topics are pretty exciting. So data practices can generate some public interest and can have some real implications, and is something that's very important to take into consideration. So I just want to give a very brief overview of the Government Data Practices Act, which is in Minnesota Statutes Chapter 13. It's important to remember that the Data Practices Act applies to government entities. It does not apply to the legislature or the courts. So the courts have their own rules of public access and other court rules that they promulgate and follow, and the legislature as well has their own rules. So the Data Practices Act, for the most part, applies to all government entities. There are some outstate non-metro townships that the act does not apply to, but for the most part, it applies to all government in Minnesota. Government data is everything in a recorded form. So the only thing it really doesn't include is what we have in our heads that we haven't kind of put onto paper yet. So it's important to keep that into consideration as government employees when they're working with their information, that everything is government data. Minnesota is unique from the federal government and from other states that we presume all of our government data is public unless there's a specific classification. So you may be familiar with the federal government and the Freedom of Information Act, and that is kind of an exemption model, and it actually, there are broad exemptions that government can use to protect data, but most of the kind of classification as we would understand it is done through litigation. So the courts are really deciding really specific classifications, is something public or should it be protected. In Minnesota, we have a bit of a unique structure that we're combining both our transparency law and our privacy law into one statute in Chapter 13. So we have our law deals with privacy rights as well as openness, and it has very specific classifications. And that's where it's important for the legislature to have an understanding of some of these issues, because you're tasked with providing those specific classifications. So we have our law appears to be a lot longer than some of the other state laws and the federal government, because the legislature decides those very specific classifications, and it's not kind of a discretionary exemption model like we're seeing in other states and the federal government. So as I mentioned, government data is everything. The way the definition was created back in the 70s when the law came to be was that it would include all kinds of media with technology advances and everything that we're seeing. Email, of course, is included. Videos are included. Everything's included. What the courts have said is not included are our mental impressions. So something has to be in recorded form for it to be government data. The classification scheme in the Data Practices Act appears complicated, but really it's not. There are kind of three broad areas of classification that it's important to understand when you're considering if something should be protected or not. Public, of course, anyone can have the data. The law specifies that the government can't ask someone why they want the data. They can't ask the person to identify themselves if they're requesting public data. So the request can be made anonymously. It's just kind of that broad openness when something is public. If something is private or non-public, so private data would apply to data on individuals, non-public data applies to data on businesses or computers or snowplows or something like that. That classification is a little bit more limited, so it's not open to the general public, but it is open to the data subject. So that individual can have access to private or non-public data about him or herself, or they can also provide consent to someone else to have access to the data. So they can give the government permission to release that to those individuals they choose. The access to private or non-public data within a government is limited to those individuals who have a work assignment to see the data. So again, it's not open to just every employee at a government entity. It has to be someone that actually works with those data. The last classification is the most limited classification, and that's confidential or protected non-public. And again, confidential is for individuals, protected non-public for businesses or items. And the difference between that and private or non-public is the data subject does not have access. And so the biggest example of that is active investigative data, both criminal or civil investigative data, where giving the subject access to that data would jeopardize an investigation. So you're not seeing a lot of confidential or protected non-public classifications in law because it is so limited in who has access to it. There are a couple of other laws related to the Data Practices Act that it's important to highlight. The first is the Official Records Act, and that law basically just says that government employees have to create official records to document their activities. And it's both so the public knows what the government is doing, as well as to pass that information on to successors in office so government is not constantly recreating the wheel, that we know why we've done something and can follow along with that. There isn't a definition of official records in law. So it really is up to a government entity to make determinations as to what constitutes an official record. It's important to make the distinction between an official record and government data. So as I mentioned, government data is everything. The minute you put something into recorded form or take notes on something, it becomes government data. That doesn't necessarily make it an official record. So government has to make determinations about what actually constitutes an official record. A final report or something that has more official nature is going to be an official record, as opposed to your notes from a meeting. That may become part of an official record, but your notes in and of itself are just government data until they become something of an official nature. Along with that is the Records Management Statute, and that statute dictates that government has to have retention schedules for how long they're required to maintain data. So again, there isn't a law that dictates how long certain official records have to be maintained. It is up to the government entity to make those decisions, and then it goes through a records disposition panel to make those final determinations. So you could have situations where some government has a retention schedule for 5 years for a given piece of data or an official record, and others may have a different retention period. So again, that's going to be something, it's a requirement of government entities to have, and that dictates how long they have to keep something and when they can dispose of official records. When we talk about the Data Practices Act, we like to use the example of a three-legged stool, and that's kind of the policy, the way to think about some of these policy decisions. There are three components. So government has a need to have data to do its work. It's important that government has information to make decisions about what they're doing. The next leg of the stool is maintaining an accountable and transparent government, and that's very important for the public to have an eye into what government's doing, for the government to explain their actions. And then the third leg is protecting privacy rights. So you always want to take those three considerations into account when making decisions about whether data should be public or should have some sort of protection. So in using that stool, we've kind of set out the three important things to remember for the legislature is what I mentioned before. We're presuming everything's public. So as the legislature, if you feel that something should not be public, you have to make that specific classification either as private or non-public or confidential or protected non-public. Otherwise, we're going to presume it's public if there's not a specific classification. The legislature also gets to decide how data are protected, if you want it to have that very limited classification of confidential, or if the subject should have access in private data, and allows for any sharing. So you can put into law, if you have private data, generally only that specific data subject has access and the government that has the data, but you can decide, well, the Department of Administration should be able to share those data with the Department of Commerce for these specific purposes. So you get to decide any of those specific sharings as well. And then, as I mentioned, just keeping that three-legged stool in your mind and making those policy decisions. So I'm going to give you a little quiz, and you have the answers in front of you because of the format of the PowerPoint slide. But I wanted to use these examples to highlight some of the issues that some of the other parts of the Data Practices Act that you're going to hear about in terms of classification and some of the issues that we've heard about in the last couple of years. So a government employee salary is, of course, public. And that's kind of the big example of allowing the public to know how their taxpayer dollars are being spent and how much government employees are being paid. So the name of a person arrested, their name is, of course, public. And I wanted to point out that particular area because it deals with the section of the Data Practices Act in law enforcement data, in section 13.82. And that's likely a section that you're going to be hearing about with regard to the issues Mr. Gehring pointed out with automatic license plate readers and police body camera data. In the law enforcement data section, what the legislature has done is set out three areas that are always public data. So they have not only said, okay, we have the presumption that some data are public, we want to make sure these data are always public, even if there is an active criminal investigation. And those are in the areas of arrest data, request for service data, and response or incident data. And there are very specific data elements that are set out that are always public. So you will hear about that section when you have discussions about automatic license plate readers and police body camera data, because those data, even in those areas, so for example, in police body cameras, those data are always going to be public. So it'll be up to the legislature to make some decisions as to whether those provisions should remain in effect with regard to body cameras or if there should be some tweaks to that. The next area is email addresses on a city's snow emergency notification list. And I point this one out. Those are private, and I point that out because it was a recent legislative change a couple of years ago where the legislature weighed those policy considerations. An email address up until a couple of years ago was presumptively public. There just wasn't a specific classification for it. So the legislature weighed the privacy considerations and the transparency considerations in making decisions as to whether those email addresses should be protected and came down on the side of protecting them. The next area is a complaint about a school superintendent. And I wanted to point out this section to highlight section 13.43 in the Data Practices Act, which is the personnel data section. So that deals with any data about government employees, and it sets out specific data that are public. So what that section says is all data about government employees are private except for these specific data elements that the legislature has set out. With regard to a complaint, the only thing that is public, assuming there's no discipline, is the existence and status of a complaint about just a general employee, and the substance of a complaint, if there isn't any final disposition of discipline, remains private. I want to just highlight the difference between general employees and what the legislature has defined as a public official in the personnel data section. And we had a recent advisory opinion that dealt with a school principal, and then subsequent to his resignation, there was a request for all of the data related to that particular complaint and resignation. And what the legislature did many years ago was to define a state public official and say basically everything about those public officials is public because they're at such a high level. A couple of years ago, they extended some of that openness to local public officials, so principal or superintendent or high-level folks at cities. So what the opinion highlighted was that this principal, even though there was not discipline in this situation, much of the data about that complaint and resignation was public. So again, it's kind of a delineation between just general employees and public officials and what the public has a right to know. The next area, the name of an owner on a dog license, that's public, and I just wanted to highlight that as one of the presumptively public areas that we sometimes get questions about. Active criminal investigative data, and I've told you that that's confidential, and I wanted to just highlight again with the issues that you'll likely be hearing about with police body camera data, that inactive criminal investigative data are all public. And so it's just an important area to keep under consideration in making some of those decisions about the treatment of police body cameras. So that while it's active, it's confidential, but once it's inactive, everything is public.
Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I want to get to that. So you're talking about body cameras, and presumptively it then becomes public information after there's no investigation. But what about protected information inside? For example, children present in the video. Do you have you issued any opinions on that?
Ms. Christensen.
Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, great question. And so how the law works right now is there are certain protected identities in the law enforcement section, and that will still apply to any inactive criminal investigative data. And that's going to be in police reports or body cameras or any sort of information. So victims of criminal sexual conduct, undercover law enforcement officers, that information will still have to be redacted from a video or a police report or something like that. So there are certain protected identities that will remain protected even in an inactive investigation. Does that answer your question?
Follow up? Okay, good. Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Ms. Christensen, you stated that the data becomes public once the investigation is concluded. Who decides when the investigation is concluded?
There's a statute. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
It's okay.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, there's a statutory definition in Section 1382. So it's when the appeals rights have been exhausted. There are a number of areas that I think there's three areas that you have to look to in determining if something is inactive.
Representative Lesh?
Okay. Well, that's adequate for now, Madam Chair. I'd like to bring it up at a further meeting, but thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Christensen, any other questions? Ms. Christensen, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the next example I have is another confidential example. And a person who complains to law enforcement about the party next door has a confidential classification. So your identity is protected with regard to complaints about real property. And then finally, the example I want to highlight, and I think this pairs nicely with Representative Hillstrom's question, the name of a delinquent juvenile is private. So that's always going to be something that's protected in police reports or videos or anything that a juvenile delinquent, basically, their identity is always protected. I wanted to highlight that's kind of your bad actor kids, but you also have other kids that may be witnesses or victims. And they have some protection in the Data Practices Act, but it's sometimes discretionary. It's not automatic. So a juvenile victim, for example, will have to ask for protection, and law enforcement can protect those identities. And juvenile witnesses are protected if law enforcement deems that there would be some sort of justification for protecting their identities. So a little bit different than your juvenile delinquent folks that have automatic protection. Victims and witnesses, there are some decision points that government has to make. So just to move on to a little bit more information about the topics that Mr. Gehring discussed with regard to the Data Practices Commission, temporary classifications of data. So as I mentioned, the Commissioner of Administration has authority to classify data until the legislature can act. And those classifications expire on August 1st of the year following submission to the legislature. So the example that the only current temporary classification we have right now is with regard to automatic license plate reader data, and that classification expires this summer on August 1st. So it's been 2 years since that has been submitted to the legislature. The temporary classification for those data was a partial approval, and the reason that the commissioner was only able to partially approve some of the data as protected is because some of the data already have a classification in statute. So the temporary classification authority doesn't allow the commissioner to reclassify data. It just can classify presumptively public data. So what we found with the license plate reader data is they requested the city of Minneapolis requested classification for a lot of related data, but some of it was already protected as active investigative data or inactive investigative data. Some of it was already public as arrest data, requests for service or response or incident data. So the specific data that the classification covers are items of data that weren't already specifically classified. So the image of the license plate, that type of information is currently private or non-public. So the legislature will have to make decisions about the classification of those data if you don't want the classification to expire in August. The slide also lists one of the recent disapproved classification and some of the rejected classifications. This is a pretty limited, that we don't receive a lot of these requests for temporary classification. It was put into statute when the legislature was only meeting every other year, so there was a period of time when the legislature didn't have the ability to act, and it was more of an emergency classification. So that's why we don't see very many of these requests very often. Finally, I just wanted to highlight the new provisions related to government contract data. Again, expanding on what Mr. Gehring talked about, the new provision in Section 13.05, Subdivision 11, imposes the requirements of the Data Practices Act on government contractors regardless of whether the actual notice about that is included in the contract. So the legislature basically took 10 or 12 years of what the Court of Appeals had determined and the commissioner had determined through advisory opinions and put that into law, that we're going to assume that if you're contracting for a function of government, that those provisions apply. The healthcare provider, the health plans have an exemption on those requirements they will be subject to the law beginning June 30th of 2015 if the legislature doesn't make any additional changes to that. So they kind of have a temporary exemption from those requirements.
Ms. Christensen, if I might, under the first bullet point there regarding contractors, government contractors' information, contracts being public, also the subcontractors is according to the court ruling, then would become public as well.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So basically, if you're performing a government function and it's either in the contract or the subcontract, it could extend. It's important to point out that the courts have not provided a definition for government function, and there's not a definition for government function in the statute as well. So right now the law basically just says to perform any of its functions. So that's kind of been an open question, I think, that the courts have been struggling with as to what constitutes a government function.
Thank you, Ms. Christian.
And that is all I have in terms of presentation, but I'm happy to answer any follow-up questions folks have.
Members, do you have any questions? Representative Lush.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Christensen, some of the newer members of the committee may be interested to know how their personal information is dealt with under the Data Practices Act, for example, emails, etc. What do new members need to be aware of in terms of whether they're taking official actions or unofficial actions?
Ms. Christensen.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, I'm going to say it depends, and you'll probably hear that from me very often with regard to this law. But because the legislature isn't subject to the Data Practices Act, it's really going to depend on how if a particular legislator is corresponding with a member of government. Likely, again, we're going to assume that it's presumptively public unless there's a specific classification that allows for it to be protected. When legislators are corresponding with each other, again, the Data Practices Act doesn't reach to the legislature, so there isn't going to be any sort of transparency rules in the Data Practices Act that would apply to that.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is actually a question for you.
Okay.
Do you know yet if you're going to have a data practices subcommittee? And if you are or are not, do you plan to have more like one omnibus data practices bill, or do you plan to send many of these bills with data practices issues off on their own?
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Good question. We're not going to have a separate committee. This committee is going to be taking up those issues. What I would like to see is an overall, on this law enforcement data, I would like to see an overall policy. I think we have to address some of these specifics now, but I think I would like to see an overall policy so that we don't have to come back to the legislature every time there's a new advancement in technology that's going to be used. As for some of the other issues, I really haven't determined yet if it's going to be part of an omnibus bill yet or if they're going to travel alone. We'll just kind of have to see how they play out. You know, if we address school data, for instance, many states have a student protections policy, again, an overall policy. So some of these things would be big enough issues in and of themselves to travel alone. But if there's some ancillary things, some smaller things, yes, we may have an omnibus. So I don't know if that answers your question. It's kind of all over the place. But
it does. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from members? Well, thank you, Ms. Christensen. And before Mr. Neumeister gives his testimony, I just want to plug Law School for Legislators. It's sponsored by the Minnesota Association for Justice and William Mitchell College of Law, and it is on a Friday morning. I think it usually starts at 8:30. Yes, it does. And we'll be reviewing a number of topics. I'm going to send out some handouts, and I would encourage everyone to come. The topics that they are going to be addressing are topics that we're going to be addressing in this committee, so I think it would be helpful not just for members of this committee to be in attendance, just to get a better understanding and be able to answer questions that aren't necessarily on the record. You feel maybe a little more comfort level in asking some of the questions at Law School for Legislators. I believe they provide us lunch, so there will be free food. I see Carl up there nodding her head. And so I encourage you to put that on your calendars if you can. If you can make it for all or most of that, that would be great to have you there. Mr. Neumeister, please come forward. Please state your name for the record and let us know kind of who you are around here.
Chair Scott and former Chair Lesh and members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. I want to thank you very much for the few moments that you're going to allow me to give a citizen's perspective on the Data Practices Act, and who since the age of 15, will be 60, have been asking government information verbally and writtenly over many thousands of times. And I know how to get information pretty well, and what the law is, and the concept of right to know, and all those kinds of things. And this will be the beginning of my 38th session here at the state legislature as a citizen, non-paid person, coming up here testifying on privacy, civil liberties, and open government. So many of the laws that are referred to and how they've become or whatever, I've been involved in the forefront of many of those fights or observing a large amount aspects of that. For almost 10 years, I was up here full time because I just worked on weekends. But that does not happen to me at the time of my life now. One of the things that I think is very important is that information is power. Information and data by government is the lifeblood of government. And you and your counterpart committee in the Senate is going to decide a number of things. What is public? What is private? What is not available to either the public or the subject itself? As Ms. Christensen very much stated to you, the Data Practices Act is a combination of privacy law and right-to-know law, to where you, as policymakers, get into the tidbits of it and the specifics of it, and whether or not you have good law for the local and state government to follow and the citizens and the residents of Minnesota to know, is whether or not you will take the time, whether or not you get bad information or good information. The old adage is, good law depends on good information. and then also good discussion. Now, what I have before you is a packet of information, and it's 5 pages long, and I just want to share with you at least a cartoon. Hey, Mr. Government Official, what's going on under there, under the cloak of secrecy? That is always one of the tangents in the battles that are happening. I mean, I've been told just recently, Rich, we don't like you looking at this information. This is public data. We don't know what you're going to do with it. Now, this was with an agency that has done some bad things. And 3 years ago, they were in the news and all that. Just recently, I decided to find out if they're still doing the bad things. The head person was saying to me, Rich, before you talk to anybody, I want you to talk to me. You know, so at least they don't expose some things or, from my viewpoint, some bad things. Well, the other kind of responses you get is, I'm sorry, Mr. Neumeister, that's going to cost $1.2 million. Not necessarily $1.2 million, but they say it's going to cost a lot of money to do a lot of that stuff. Not knowing under the law, which is very clear, that when you plan these computers and when you plan your data, that they have to be basically readily and easily accessible. Government entities don't like to do those kinds of things. So I just ply into those and ply a little bit into the cartoon here. Now, I want to give you some examples of some of the data requests that I've made. One of the ones that you'll see is an email that was sent to Sheriff Sheriff Mueller of Olmsted County. Over the last 4 years, I've done at least nearly 40 requests on license plate readers on almost any agency that uses them, how they got them, and all that. And what I've gotten back is information how they use them, how they plan to use them, what the future holds. I have gotten plans from the agencies or the companies that give the information how to set up all these. So I pretty much know a lot about LPR and how law enforcement wants to use them, how they integrate, how they want to integrate that data, and what the future of LPRs are going to be. Now, I only stress not to talk about the LPR issue, but how using the Data Practices Act and why it's important for the public to have this kind of law is that where you are discussing the policies or the locals discuss the policies or whatever it may be, so that the public, just regular Joe and Jane citizen and resident who you represent, can be on par with some of the entities of government who have more access to information, more power, or whatever. All it is part of a level playing field. The second item. One of the unique things about the Data Practices Act is that we can ask to find out if there are any status and existence of charges of employees. We see it in the news all the time. This is how the news discovers different kinds of things. So over the years, I've done, and this is with the Metro Transit officers, because there have been some issues from my perspective and working with people that in my community that sometimes Metro Transit officers are doing not so good things in interacting with community people who take the light rail and the buses and those kinds of things. So as you can see, it was recently in August. I want the names, existence, status, and employees of all the complaints since, I think it was 2011, against officers. All that is public. All that's to where it's important for people for accountability, public scrutiny. Another one. As you may know, and you've already heard about all different kinds of technology happening. So the state of Minnesota, which has spent millions of dollars and also got a couple million dollars or maybe a little bit more from the feds to do facial recognition, particularly with driver's license, to where all our photos on driver's license are facial recognition digitally, so that when entities, whether it be Department of Human Services, whether it be law enforcement or whatever, start getting on the facial recognition tangent, they'll be using the license plate readers or the license photos and being able to take a picture. And what they'll do a cross match. And they'll say, and already they do this with MRAP, with pictures that are taken of arrestees and people that are convicted. And then it comes across and it'll say like, oh, it's 98%. It's Rich Neumeister. It all depends on how the polls might be or something to that extent. So it, with just these three examples, I share with you the very important tool of the Data Practices Act. Now, the other side of the coin of the Data Practices Act, as it was so clearly stated by Stacy, and I will emphasize that again with you, is that you have a right to find out information about yourself. Now, in the last 2-3 years, I've helped many legislators who wanted to know who's been looking at my DVS database or the DVS database, because once the explosion of that information came out, or the press or whatever, that there was a lot of people looking at DVS driver's license information, and some of them were legislators. Some of you wanted to know who, where, when, and what. There's a whole panoply of issues about that, but one of the important things about the Data Practices Act in your right to be able to get access to information about yourselves is particularly in the education field, where parents are constantly fighting with school districts who want to get their rights for their kids, their proper education, whatever. I've helped Don Gemberling, who you may meet in the future, or some of you may know, has helped many, many, many people like that over the years. And it's always one of the constant issues. So it's a two-track thing, public right to know and another. Now, finally, I want to give you a classic example of how government and an individual fights over government information. And that is with the well-known, publicized issue about spy technology called Stingray Kingfish, where the state of Minnesota spent $632,000 on a little piece of equipment that emulates a cell phone device or antenna and then collects information on innocent people and also the targeted person. So your location data, they haven't released a lot of information. It could be text messages. When you look at some of the other material that's out on the web by the people who make these things, they can also intercept. Whether or not that's happening or not, conjecture, I need more information yet. But nobody knew about these things other than the Kingfish was owned by Rich Stanek. Last September of 2013, I made a data request to the BCA. Hey, do you have a Stingray? And it was the most toughest deal that I've had in my 40 years, 38 years of the data. The Data Practices Act is 40 years old. I've been doing it for 38 of those 40 years. It was the toughest one that I had to deal with. So I asked the BCA for a basic contract and just some general public information. BCA tells me no. Reason why, it's trade secret. The bad guys, if they find out, will do stuff with it. And so I tried 3 times. I went to the legislature. Legislature decided, hey, there's a strong public interest to find out. Some of your members and on this committee and others did a letter to the BCA, and they got a written thing back. But I still wanted the contract. I still wanted to know some other things. So they said no. So I went to a newspaper entity, and they said no. So then I talked around, and there was an interest of James Schiffer, the Star Tribune. And who then decided to make a request? But now a Star Tribune has resources. It's not like a Rich Neumeister who can go out and hire a lawyer or any other citizen, and that's one of the other things that's important. Many times entities are told no, and it's very hard for citizens. So sometimes you'll get questions. Hey, can you help me out a little bit? Can you help me out with the school district? You as constituents will come and ask you. And I've helped many of you, and other Gemberling and other folks have done to help you help your constituents on some of those things. So Mr. Schiffer asked for the contract of the Stingray and asked for any other information. He was told no first time. But then he asked for an opinion, which was talked about here, IPAD. What did the opinion say? The opinion basically said that contracts are public. Now, the BCA, in its fight, when they went to the commissioner to IPAD, he said, this data is so intertwined with the public and the private, we can't give it to you. Now, that argument did not hold. And now I have my own opinions about the BCA and all that regards, and I've shared them publicly in the Privacy Commission. I won't say that here unless you ask me. But what out of that evidence that happened was you know, even with all my efforts and doing three times and knowing what the law was, but it took a threat and a highly paid attorney and the power of the Star Tribune to get basically public information that should have been public from the first place. I only illustrate that to you because your constituents and citizens and residents of Minnesota are constantly in those kinds of fights, particularly when it's information that the entity does not want you or the public to know about. Now, all that is documented about the Stingray. It's all public, you know, and I'll share anything with you in that regard. Now, the last cartoon. The last cartoon says, "May I help you, sir?" And basically, it's a citizen saying, "I wish to file an FOIA request." We'll call it the data request. FOIA, you'll hear a lot, is also called Freedom of Information. Then you've got the mayor and the elected official saying, those instigators, making a Freedom of Information request? What is this? America? Of course it's America. America has it's basically, in Minnesota, America, a right to know, right to privacy. I try to emulate my belief in what America's all about. And that's why I feel so strongly about the kinds of things. And that's why I've given you at least some type of citizen perspective in a broad, general way. And I'll give you a little bit more in detail if any of you are any help in the future. I want to leave you with one item that you might want to read on your own. Mary Liz Holberg, who many of you know, for 16 years was across party lines a champion on data practices, privacy, right to know. And she got into it, and she sort of said she did a one-piece page called "Why One Legislator Cares About Data Practices," because it can be very insightful, particularly for you as new freshmen. Because she says, as a freshman legislator in 1999, I was given the dreaded assignment of the Civil Law Committee. That's her first paragraph. But at the end of the paragraph, completely different, because some of the things she learned as she served the committee, served her constituents, and served the residents and citizens of Minnesota on an important topic. So, Madam Chair, former Chair Lesh, I want to thank you, and members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for the moments of your time and in all just trying to give you a sense of how important this law is for the folks you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Newmeister. Representative Schoen, question?
Thank you, Madam.
A little microphone problem.
There we go. All right, Madam Chair, Mr. Newmeister. We've talked many times, mm-hmm. and what I impression I get, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that your goal is to obtain data as it is under the law. What I've never asked, and this kind of came to me probably over the summer, was how do you handle data and how do you think we should handle data as a matter of public safety? For instance, the contract with the BCA, there is issues related to public safety, but the opinion was it should be public data. So how do you think we should handle that? Because at the federal level, they have intelligence committees where elected officials are presented information and make decisions on whether that should be public or if it's something that is concerning. Is that something we should have at the state level, that people elected by the people look at these things and then decide whether it goes from there? Because the electeds, for instance, if we had an intelligence subcommittee or something within the state legislature, that we were able to talk about these things and make informed decisions, how would you handle that?
Mr. Newmeister.
Madam Chair and Director Schoen, no. I don't believe there should be a subcommittee of secrecy or privacy or whatever, or intelligence. I just look at on the federal level right now and in Congress on many issues and problems of having an intelligence committee. And one of those kinds of things is there's a lot of public information that they hide and pigeonhole in the Intelligence Committee.
Madam Chair.
Now, may I just answer now in regards to following up? And let's use the BCA as an example. Mm-hmm. Whether or not you've looked at the contract or not, it's all public. there's nothing that's going to end the world. You know, the one of the other things that I've always noticed about with secrecy, and is, oh, you'll see it in the federal level, because you referred, Madam Chair, Dan, Representative Schoen, to the federal level. There's a lot of things that they put in there, and the public doesn't have a right to know. Now, the whole issue of the Stingray and the Harris Corporation and finance, because the BCA didn't want to say who even the corporation was, you know, about all this secret, this is going to, you know, this is not available to the public. It's very clear it should be the public. Now, in regards to specific kinds of things about technology, it's easily to find. It's easy to find on the web, on the internet. I mean, I have 50-page reports about stingrays and all that that tell me a lot, and they're the ones, who, you know, the folks who are selling it. You know, so it's all available. So the penchant for having a special committee for secrecy to discuss these kinds of things, I would oppose personally.
Madam Chair?
Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Neumeister, do you believe that there are any matters that are specific to public safety and jeopardizing public safety that should be kept secret in the matter and the interest of public safety?
Mr. Neumeister.
Madam Chair and Representative Schoen, sure, but I need to know what those are, or at least have some discussion of what those are. I'm not going to, because, again, I go over many, many years in the history of our country, whether you be a Republican or a Democrat, middle of the road or whatever, of how under the realm of public safety and national security and all kinds of things, they want to keep information away from the public. And there are many instances here in Minnesota where, and this is one of the fights now I'm having with a particular local agency, that are now using security information in a broad, sweeping way of where for 40 years this kind of information has been public in Minnesota, but now they want to keep it secret. And when I start asking for some of the justification of that, I get pushback and I don't get an answer. So, I mean, bureaucracies play games, and I've seen many of them. And if you have a broad swath of where something can be kept secret, it'll be kept secret and it'll be hard for the public to know. So yes, Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, there are some things, and we've made provisions for that in current law under 1382, since it's been around since about 1979, 1980. And there will still be discussion on aspects of that, and I'm sure that will continue to happen. And then that's why we have a legislature. That's why in Minnesota the approach is we discuss those kinds of things, what should be public, what should not be, with elected officials rather than a court decide.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister, for your testimony. And committee members, as you can see, this is not an easy subject to get to the bottom of. There, you've got to find that where the law stands between privacy and the people's right to know, and it's not an easy thing to put your finger on. So this committee will do its best to work on those issues and try to protect both of those. Seems to be things on opposite scales. So any other questions by committee members? We're just nearing the end of our time, and I thank you so much for being here. We look forward to a vigorous debate here in this committee on many subjects, and we will not be meeting this Thursday, so you have the time off. You can sleep in that morning if you need to, and we will adjourn until Tuesday next week. Meeting's adjourned.